Detectives, what was the strangest case you've ever investigated? All right, I'm a detective now. But this happened when I was on patrol several years ago. Got a call to check the welfare of a man whose neighbor hadn't seen him in a couple of years. Why it took so long to report, I'll never know. But it was out in a rural area. Anyway, we arrived and noticed the windows were covered in mold and insects. His car was parked in the garage, and there were no signs of forced entry. We breached the door and found the man tangled in a phone cord beside a toppled chair in his dining room. He was badly decomposed, barely recognizable aside from his shape and clothing. Strong odor from the scene mixed with stagnant water and the basement from burst pipes and the insects everywhere. It's something I'll never forget. We also found two bags of groceries neatly packed on the kitchen floor. The house itself was very tidy, no witnesses. Estranged from his family, he clearly had a pet, but it was missing. Medical records showed he had a cardiac emergency history. My theory is he was having a medical episode and tried to call for help but never got the chance. The most unsettling part? His mailbox was overflowing with unpaid bills and disconnected utility notices, the most recent only a couple of months old. And it still took that long for someone to call. Next story. This happened years ago at a prison where I used to work. An unbelievable internal investigation that quickly spiraled into a major case. In the segregation unit, there was a very eccentric sergeant, a fitness enthusiast who often spent hours talking with inmates about life. He regularly went to the gym with one of the nurses who handled evening medication rounds. One night, an inmate being escorted for medication casually asked the nurse, "Going to Gold's Gym after work?" The escorting officer immediately reported it since that kind of personal information can pose a security risk. An investigation began. The sergeant and nurse confirmed they were gym partners. But soon there were anonymous reports suggesting that the sergeant was spending too much personal time around inmates. Rumors spread quickly, and other staff began avoiding him, worried that sensitive personal details might be shared. A few weeks later, investigators received allegations that the nurse was involved in an inappropriate relationship with the same inmate who made the gym comment. While they hadn't proven anything yet, administrators made sure all three individuals worked in separate areas during the inquiry. Then, investigators found something unusual. Money transfers were appearing in the inmate's account, originating from a nearby gas station. Surveillance footage confirmed it was the nurse making the deposits under an alias. Further review of procedures revealed more serious misconduct. The nurse had been violating security policies to maintain contact with the inmate, and he had intentionally broken rules to be transferred to a housing unit closer to her. It turned out the sergeant had been set up as a red herring to divert suspicion. The nurse eventually resigned, and the inmate was transferred to another facility. The case was treated as a major breach of professional conduct, given the strict standards under federal prison safety regulations. Next story. Not a detective, but I contacted my detective to run the incident by him. I was a field training officer training a new deputy for my department. We received a call about a lady stranded at a gas station, essentially a welfare check. My trainee and I responded and made contact with her. She said she was staying at a nearby hotel and didn't need help. As my trainee spoke with her, she began talking about the government, being after her and went off on a strange tangent that didn't make much sense. Her car was covered with missing posters of a man who had disappeared years ago in California. She said he was her husband and that she was on a mission to find him. Then she mentioned discovering human remains in her home. And when asked if that had been investigated, she said yes. Out of curiosity, I asked what kind of remains she meant, and she calmly said preserved specimens, specifically, toes. When I asked where they were now, she looked me in the eye and said, "They're in my purse. Would you like to see them?" In disbelief, we walked to her car, where she pulled out a sealed container with preservation fluid. Inside were three small preserved specimens. She said she found them in her house and didn't know who they belonged to. The container had sealing tape around the cap, suggesting it came from a medical setting. I contacted my investigator, and we found that it wasn't a violation of any laws to have preserved medical remains in that form. At first, I suspected she might have harmed her ex, but later learned her ex was alive and well. He had simply left for another relationship. Her sister told us she had several medical issues and had stopped following prescribed treatment, which likely explained her unusual behavior. We never did find out where the specimens came from. But investigators believe they were likely removed by a medical professional and kept by someone years earlier. Next story. My mom is also not an actual detective, but she might as well be. She's found multiple men who disappeared to avoid paying child support. One man, a toxic person with a substance issue, keeps trying to disappear and she or his former partner keep finding him. She found the former son-in-law of a neighbor from his Facebook photos, which included a photo of his car license plate. She found someone's lost retirement benefits. Long story. She also found the legal record of a guy I'd just started dating and showed it to me. Thanks, Mom. It was for a small legal issue and I already knew about it, so I didn't care that much. She used to regularly check up on her kids' dates, and she still regularly checks up on people, especially family members whom she's fallen out of contact with. She usually doesn't do anything with that info, she just collects it. Next story. I'm not a cop, but years ago, I went on a hunting trip with a city officer who told me about the very first major case he ever handled, and it's one that stuck with him for life. It started on a humid summer afternoon, when dispatch received a call about a man found badly injured outside an apartment complex. When the officer arrived, paramedics were already working frantically, and the man was still conscious for a moment. He was trying to explain what had happened, saying only a few words before he collapsed. Despite their efforts, he didn't make it. The medical team later confirmed he had suffered a serious wound to the upper body. What made the case strange was how the injury seemed to have been made worse by his own attempt to remove the object that caused it. Something people don't realize can make bleeding far worse. The officer said it was one of those moments that burned into his memory, the kind of thing they teach about in first aid classes, but that you never expect to see in real life. The investigation started quickly. Witnesses said they'd heard arguing earlier in the day, but the voices were muffled. The officers began canvassing the nearby units, trying to figure out who might have been involved. Eventually, they tracked down a woman who matched a few of the witness descriptions. She seemed calm when they arrived, not realizing what had actually happened. The officers said she spoke openly at first, saying she'd gotten into a heated argument with a man she knew, maybe a roommate or a friend of one, over something incredibly trivial. According to her, the argument started because he refused to share a piece of watermelon. The words sounded almost absurd to the officers taking her statement. It didn't make sense. How could something so small spiral into something fatal? But her story matched the evidence too closely to be coincidence. She admitted that in a burst of anger, she had grabbed a nearby tool and struck him once before storming off. She hadn't gone to check on him or called for help. She just assumed he'd be fine. When the officers told her what had actually happened, she froze. The shock on her face, the officer said, was unforgettable. She kept repeating that she hadn't meant for it to go that far, that it was just a split-second act of temper. The case wrapped up quickly after that. The forensic team confirmed the sequence of events, and it was officially closed as a domestic assault that turned tragic. The officer told me he never forgot that case, not because of the complexity, but because of how small the cause had been. "People think big crimes come from big motives," he said. "But sometimes all it takes is one bad decision made in a single, angry moment." Next story. My uncle was a detective about 35 years ago. He was investigating a string of break-ins and discovered that a man under substance influence had burrowed a hole into the foundation of an apartment building in some dead space between footers. He was living there in a nest made from newspapers and random trash. Yes, like that X-Files episode. When two officers went to pull the guy out, the man lashed out and started snapping. Apparently, as a defense mechanism, he injured his own hands and tossed pieces toward police. My uncle described the sound as like crunching into something hard. When they finally got the man out, he escaped restraint and started climbing upstairs. He was still extremely strong from the effects of the substance, so he managed to push one officer and my uncle over the stairwell before they eventually caught him. My uncle sustained a serious injury and went on permanent disability. Next story. This isn't exactly a case, but it's one of those old family stories that makes me smile every time I think about it. My granddad was the first and only one-armed detective in our small English town. Everyone knew him. He was respected, a little gruff, but with the dry sense of humor you only get from people who've seen everything life can throw at them. One summer afternoon, word came through that a bull had escaped from a nearby farm and was wandering loose through a neighboring village. It was one of those calls that no one really expects, but somehow always lands in the lap of whoever's least equipped to deal with it. That day, it was my granddad. He got the message over the radio. "Bull loose near the green. We'll need someone to handle it." Without missing a beat, he said, "Right, I'll sort it." He drove straight over to the secure storage room to pick up the proper equipment, the gear used for animal control in emergencies like this. But when he arrived and opened the storage cabinet, All he found were the basics.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Ropes, a few safety poles, and empty racks where the rest of the equipment should have been. The supplies were there, but the main tools he needed had vanished. So he called the station and asked, "Where's all the proper gear gone then? The tranquilizer equipment, the animal restraints, everything's missing." There was an awkward silence on the line before someone cleared their throat and said, "Oh, about that. We lent it out tonight to the Amateur Dramatic Society. They're putting on a play and needed props." For a moment, my granddad thought they were joking. But no. The police force had genuinely loaned out official equipment to the local theater group so they could add a touch of realism to their performance. He sighed, muttered something that probably shouldn't be repeated, and then improvised. With only a rope, a few fences, and one working arm, he managed to help the villagers guide the bull safely back toward the farm. No harm done, except perhaps to his patience. When he got back to the station later that evening, everyone was still laughing about it. "How'd you manage it then?" one of the officers asked. "Same way I manage everything else," he said dryly, "with one arm tied behind my back." That story became a bit of local legend. It summed up not just my granddad's sense of humor, but also a very different era in policing. A time when resources were scarce, communities were tight-knit, and everyone made do with what they had. Whenever I hear people talk about how things used to be simpler, I think of my granddad, standing in a field, facing down a bull with a single arm, a frayed rope, and a police department whose gear was on stage at the village theater. How times have changed. Indeed. Next story. Reminds me of this one time when I was a kid. There had been a break-in at our shed, and our bike was taken. And we heard from one neighbor that some fishing gear had gone missing from theirs. So we went around the neighborhood asking people if they'd seen anything or lost stuff. We made a list of all the missing things and went looking, and we actually found the bike at an apartment complex with cheap rooms. All of the missing items were in the bike bags. There were empty cans everywhere. So probably some poor guy under the influence had been going around taking things during a late-night stealing spree. Can't remember if we actually returned all the items or were too scared that the guy would see us, but it was actually a pretty cool memory from my childhood. Next story. Not a detective at all, but once I was working as a flagman on a construction site. I was part of a mobile unit, so we had to switch from site to site pretty often in a day. One morning, the unit chief rang my phone and told me he had a special request that day. Some of the other flagmen were dealing banned substances to ironworkers and flagmen from other companies. He thought he knew who it was, but couldn't get the chance to prove it. So he asked me to go over to that site, offer the person a break, and talk to him. Once my partner and I arrived, my partner dropped me off and went a little further down the road. I asked the guy if he knew any ways I could get some banned materials or energy pills in the area, and without even hesitating, he opened his pack and took out a bag full of stimulant pills, like hundreds of them. I received some for $20, and at the same time, my partner in the truck nearby took pictures and videos of the exchange. I took the small bag with the pills and went straight to the unit chief with it. The guy was fired immediately, and the authorities were informed soon after. Next story. Late to the party. I'm not the detective, but my uncle was for 30-plus years in a relatively small town. He had two tragic cases in the same place. There's a side road out by the town's Walmart with a railroad crossing. It's on a hill, so people would jump it all the time. A group of teens out joyriding jumped the hill and hit the power pole. The teens survived the collision, but the power line was downed. They were all severely injured by electricity when they got out of the car. I think one made it out alive. The second was at the same railroad crossing. It didn't have a guard, just a light that blinked if there was an oncoming train. A group of teen girls were riding together. They later deduced that the girls were texting and not looking. The driver's phone even had a half-finished text, so they went right in front of the passing rail car. My uncle and the others walked for miles down the track, finding debris. He retired soon after that one. Next story. I'm not in law enforcement, but this story took place not far from where I live, in a small Wyoming town called Cokeville. And it's one of the most extraordinary events ever to happen here. It started out like any other school day. Students were in their classrooms, teachers were preparing lessons, and the air buzzed with the usual chatter that fills a small town school. But by the afternoon, everything changed. A man and his wife entered the building carrying what appeared to be a large, complicated device. They gathered the teachers and students together and told them not to leave. Within minutes, the atmosphere shifted from confusion to fear. People didn't fully understand what was happening, only that they were being held inside the school by two individuals who claimed to have something dangerous. Authorities were alerted almost immediately, and word spread through town like wildfire. Parents rushed toward the building, unable to get close, their hearts breaking as they waited for news. Inside, the teachers kept the children calm, comforting them, and trying to keep order in the middle of chaos. For hours, everyone inside the school prayed, whispered, and waited. Then, without warning, there was an explosion. When the dust settled and emergency crews arrived, the most remarkable thing became clear. Every student and teacher had survived. The only lives lost that day were those of the two people who had brought the device into the school. But what happened next is what makes this story so unforgettable. In the aftermath, as investigators tried to understand how everyone made it out alive, the children began to share their experiences. Many of them said they saw people dressed in white, calm, glowing figures who stood between them and the blast. Some said these figures guided them toward safety. Others said they felt someone holding their hands or shielding them at the moment of impact. At first, the adults brushed it off as shock or imagination. But when several of the children were later shown old family photographs, something incredible happened. Some pointed to faces in the pictures, relatives who had passed away long before, and said, "That's who was there. They were helping us." Investigators later discovered that the device hadn't worked as it was designed to. Certain parts had malfunctioned, preventing a much greater tragedy. The official explanation never quite satisfied those who were there that day, and the town still talks about it as something beyond ordinary understanding. A miracle, or at least something that can't be easily explained by science alone. Even now, decades later, people in Cokeville remember that day not only for the terror, but also for what came after. A sense that something larger than all of them had intervened. Whether you believe in miracles, fate, or just luck, it's hard to deny that something extraordinary happened in that little Wyoming town. Next story. Does private detective count? My team and I were after a guy who was suspected of cheating the system for workers' compensation. Almost all our cases were, for years. Except this guy was a fairly well-respected, physically challenged archery champion. We watched him at a competition, taking forever to try and knock his arrow with a weak hand, from a stroke, while sitting in his wheelchair. Accident at work, can't walk. Then he got home, walked around his handicap van, got his wheelchair out of the van with the lift, and pushed the thing to his house with both hands. Some people really disappoint. I mean, we knew something was not right, but nobody expected that. And one time I had to verify the residency of a certain Middle Eastern dictator's former secretary, a few years before he was faced with severe punishment. I actually only found her house, but never saw her. He had tons of secretaries over the years, so there was no suspicion of anything unusual going on. Just something that passed over my desk one day and seemed worth mentioning. Next story was a store detective and loss prevention officer in my younger years. I covered a number of large outlet clothing stores across my region. One particular Christmas period, we were having a serious problem with an organized group of people stealing from stores. They were targeting several locations and taking thousands of dollars worth of clothing at a time. For reasons that later became clear, they always seemed one step ahead, targeting stores I had just left or wasn't scheduled at that day. One day my ride broke down, and I borrowed my cousin's car to get to work. Within 2 hours of my shift, I managed to detain the group and recover a trolley with about $2,500 worth of clothing. During the interview with the main suspect, he admitted his partner worked at one of the stores and had given him inside information about me, my vehicle, and my license plate. That's how they had been tracking me and avoiding detection. The female accomplice was dismissed, and the other three faced legal action. Next story. I'm not a detective, But one morning, I woke up to what can only be described as a breakfast crime scene. Sitting on the kitchen counter was an open McDouble wrapper. Empty, except for the buns. No cheese, no patty, not even a hint of ketchup. Just two lonely pieces of bread sitting there like evidence waiting to be examined. At first I assumed it was the cat. She's sneaky, fast, and has a long history of food-related offenses. But something didn't add up. There were no scratch marks, no teeth marks, and the wrapper wasn't torn open the way she usually attacks things. Whoever had done this had used hands. I started my investigation immediately. The suspect list was short, just me, my mom, and my brother. I knew I wasn't the culprit, and my mom isn't exactly the midnight snack type. That left one possible suspect, my brother. Still, I didn't want to jump to conclusions. The cat had been falsely accused before. The great chicken tender incident of 2021 still loomed over her reputation. I had to clear her name. So, I waited for my brother to wake up, and casually asked if he knew anything about the missing McDouble. His reaction said it all. He froze mid-yawn, eyes wide, like a deer caught in the headlights of justice. I gave him the look, the same look every detective gives when they already know the answer. He sighed and confessed almost immediately. "All right," he said. I was completely out of it. I only wanted the meat. Apparently, sometime during the night, he stumbled into the kitchen, unwrapped the McDouble, ate only the patty, and left everything else perfectly in place. He didn't even crumple the wrapper. Just ate the meat, left the buns, and walked away like some kind of burger bandit. Mystery solved. The cat was innocent, my brother was guilty, and the McDouble had met a tragic, one-sided fate. When I told my mom, she laughed so hard she nearly dropped her coffee. The cat, however, sat in the corner giving me that I-told-you-so look that only cats can pull off. It's funny now, but in the moment, I felt like a real detective cracking the case of the midnight burger theft. The evidence, the questioning, the confession, all there. The only thing missing was dramatic background music and a trench coat. So yeah, I might not be a detective, but I did clear an innocent suspect, catch the real culprit, and restore order to our household. And as for my brother? Well, let's just say he's still banned from midnight snacking unsupervised. Case closed. Justice served. Medium rare. Next story. Obligatory. Not a detective, but I had a few weird army experiences in my time. At the end of a major field exercise, think tanks, helicopters, jets, artillery, the whole shebang, it's customary to lock up the supplies and have a little party before everyone heads back to their home units and loved ones. Two. Guys went missing that night and were AWOL from their unit's roll call. The next morning, when it was time to get on the buses and go home, while the army was searching the camp for them, one of the guy's dads used a Find My iPhone app and found his son collapsed in the middle of a field beside some train tracks almost an hour's drive away from the training area. Alive, but unresponsive. Later, they found that the second guy was in the custody of local authorities from a city about 3 hours away. Apparently, these two decided they wanted out of the training area immediately, jumped a fence and hitched a ride on a nearby train. Partway through the trip, one of them decided he didn't want to stay on anymore and tried the old under-the-influence tuck and roll while the train was in motion. The second guy stayed on until the next stop in the city, where he was detained because the conductor had seen them get on. Still a better outcome than the first guy, who spent weeks in a long recovery state. Normal people don't join the army. Next story. Not a detective, but some strange things happened toward the end of high school and during my first deployment. I took Japanese with a guy in high school who was pretty quiet, but we'd have small side conversations about which anime we were watching at the time. So I thought he was pretty chill. One day, he got pulled from class, and nobody I asked knew why. When I got home, my mom, who's friends with local law enforcement, said that his dad had taken the lives of his mom and both of his grandparents and was at the school trying to pick him up for unknown reasons. The disturbing part? Reports said that after the incident, he left the remains where they were, took a shower, and then ate a full meal next to them before attempting to go to the school, where he was intercepted. It was 4:30 a.m. when I wrote this originally and forgot to explain what happened to my classmate. He didn't come to school for about a month, and when he returned, he seemed completely detached, like a person on autopilot. I tried talking to him just to take his mind off everything, but he was unresponsive. Eventually, he stopped coming altogether, and nobody knew what happened to him. Fast forward 7 years, I saw him again in public. I didn't approach, but he looked peaceful, like someone who had finally found some sense of calm. I truly hope he moved on. We might have been seniors, but we were still kids. and no kid should experience that kind of tragedy. Next story. When I was enlisted in the Marines, I deployed to South Korea to train the ROK Marines in updated mortar and patrolling techniques. We moved around the country a lot. At one point, we ended up at Osan Air Force Base for about 4 days, which was a rough experience. Because we were an infantry unit, the base general restricted Air Force personnel to their barracks whenever we were outside, and they even got hazard pay for it. We built a makeshift rest area out of old couches and plywood tables. One night, I decided to sleep there because the guy in the tent next to mine had gotten into an altercation and made a mess between our racks. Around 3 a.m., I was sitting at one of the tables when a Marine I'd never seen before walked up to me with both hands clenched shut. He wasn't part of my unit, which was strange since ours was supposed to be the only Marine unit there. He started saying, "I can't help what happens, but no matter what, he will always be my friend." I stayed silent, trying to plan how to protect myself if things turned bad. He kept repeating things like, "I didn't want to harm him, but sometimes we do these things to our friends." Then he opened his hands, one holding a small bird, and the other a separated part of it. His eyes were empty, and his grin felt eerie, like there was no emotion behind it. I stood my ground, but he just turned around and walked out. When I woke up the next morning, I saw feathers on the ground beside me. Later, a buddy mentioned there was a bird without its head behind the rest area. Nobody ever saw that guy again, or figured out how he even got into our camp, since the only way out was through official release by our battalion commander. Next story. No longer a detective, so I feel like I can share. There was a really wealthy family in town. The grandfather was an author or writer who had built a strong legacy over the years. All of his family members were taking advantage of his wealth. He had a few kids. One daughter who worked in real estate. Her dad never trusted the man she married. The middle child had passed away a few years earlier, but his wife was still connected to the family, taking money from the grandfather under the pretense that it was for her daughter's college tuition. The youngest son worked for the publishing company the grandfather had created. The whole family was a mess. Very dysfunctional, and only involved with the grandfather because of his money. As we learned more about the case, that became painfully clear. Anyway, one night after a family gathering, the grandfather ended his own life. We were called to the investigation site to analyze the forensic evidence and talk with everyone involved. We interviewed all the family members, and it took a couple of days. It seemed like a textbook situation. The grandfather was elderly and tired of the conflicts surrounding him. Then, out of nowhere, just as we were about to close the case, a private investigator showed up. He ended up turning everything we'd concluded upside down, completely taking over the case. I'd never been removed from a case before, especially by someone outside our local office. Yet there we were, being told what to do by a private investigator. Long story short, he discovered that the grandson had actually planned the act. Things didn't unfold as he expected, but about 90 minutes later, we finally understood what had truly happened. I'll never forget that case. It replays in my mind all the time, even now. I find myself thinking about it again and again. Next story. I've worked as a forensic expert in the field of computer science for several years, and I've come across some truly unusual and unexpected digital cases. One of my early investigations involved analyzing several hard drives that turned out to contain thousands of inappropriate files that violated online content laws. In another case, I examined a mobile device connected to disturbing and illegal behavior involving animals, which was quickly escalated to the proper authorities. There was also a heartbreaking case involving a woman who lost about $50,000 to an online scammer. The scammer pretended to be a soldier overseas, convincing her to send money under false promises of love and future plans. When he disappeared, she reported everything to the police, who brought her devices to us for analysis. Finally, there was a case where police seized about 20 computers from a small company suspected of financial fraud. Unfortunately, due to a misunderstanding, only the monitors were collected instead of the actual computers, which forced the investigation to be closed early. Next story. Not a detective, but something strange happened in my apartment complex. It's a gated community with 5 buildings, and one morning a huge crowd gathered outside one of them. People had heard a loud noise around 3 a.m., and when they went to check, they found that something tragic had happened involving a resident from an upper floor. One of my friend's dads was first on the scene since he lived nearby. Things became even more suspicious when the resident's family members reacted oddly calm, which made the local police curious. They decided to review the building's security footage for clues. The investigation revealed that the event was not what it first appeared to be. The authorities discovered signs that the woman might have been in danger that night, and that someone close to her could have been involved. The person under suspicion left town shortly afterward, and further checks uncovered troubling information about their past. For almost a month, everyone in that building was terrified. Residents asked for escorts to their apartments at night because no one felt completely safe anymore. Next story. Not a detective, but this is one story that's always stayed with me. When I was about 15, I rode the bus to school every morning. There was a younger girl, maybe 10, who always sat across from me and chatted during the ride. She was cheerful, bright, and had this way of bringing out the protective big brother instinct in everyone around her. Months later, our small town was shaken by devastating news involving her family. At first, everyone thought it was a tragic domestic situation, something that had gone terribly wrong at home. But when the investigation unfolded, the truth that came out left everyone speechless. It turned out that the story wasn't what it first seemed, and the person everyone thought was the victim had actually orchestrated everything. There had never been any signs of mistreatment or trouble at home, which made the revelation even more chilling. I'll never forget how surreal it felt to realize that I'd spent months talking with someone capable of something so dark, all while thinking she needed protection. Next story. I'm a 911 dispatcher, and one of the strangest calls I've ever handled still gives me chills. It was around 3 a.m. in Broward County, about 5 years ago. I was working the TAC radio when we got reports of a major highway collision involving an 18-wheeler and a box truck near an exit on a deserted stretch of road. The crash was serious, vehicles heavily damaged, people trapped, and a fire reported. According to witnesses, a man appeared out of nowhere and pulled the passengers to safety, sitting them neatly by the roadside and staying with them until emergency crews arrived. We dispatched every available unit, police, fire, and highway patrol. Within minutes, the scene was filled with flashing lights. When firefighters went to check on the rescuer, one of them briefly took hold of his arm to guide him away from the wreckage. But when they turned back, he was gone, just vanished. Crews searched the area for over an hour, thinking maybe he'd been hurt and wandered off. But nobody ever saw him again. To this day, no one knows who that man was or where he came from. I still get goosebumps every time I tell the story. It felt like something otherworldly had stepped in to help that night. Next story. I wasn't a detective, but I was the person everyone turned to whenever something went wrong with the computers. Back in the 1990s, that made me a sort of tech guy by default. Computers weren't as common then, and the hardware was expensive. RAM sticks cost anywhere from $50 to $75 per megabyte. Every piece of equipment in a computer lab was worth a small fortune. So when a strange incident happened at our local computer lab, I was called in to help figure it out. The situation seemed simple at first, but the more we looked into it, the stranger it became. It started when a few students began complaining that the lab's computers were unusually slow. Programs that had once opened instantly were now taking ages to load. At first, we thought it was just normal wear and tear, or maybe some software issue. But when I ran a basic diagnostic, I noticed something odd. Each computer had far less memory than it was supposed to. Originally, every system had 4 sticks of 4 MB RAM, totaling 16 MB per computer, which was a big deal at the time. But now every single machine had been downgraded to 4 1 MB sticks. That meant someone had gone through, one by one, opened up each computer, carefully removed the more valuable memory modules, and replaced them with smaller ones so the theft wouldn't be obvious. In total, 12 computers had been tampered with, 48 RAM sticks swapped out without a trace. We contacted the building administrators, who immediately began checking security logs and records. Unfortunately, this was long before widespread digital surveillance. There were no security cameras, and the building didn't use keycards or electronic locks. The only record we had was a physical sign-in sheet that anyone could have written on. Worse yet, the time frame for when the incident occurred was unbelievably broad, sometime between September 1st and January 10th. The lab was open nearly every day during that period, which meant dozens of students, teachers, and staff had come and gone freely. Whoever had done it was smart. They hadn't forced any doors or broken anything, and the lab didn't show any signs of disturbance. Everything was neat, almost surgical. They had taken the good memory sticks, replaced them with cheaper ones, and left the computers running perfectly fine, just slower. When we calculated the total loss, it was a few $1,000s worth of hardware, which was no small sum in the 90s. Yet despite the financial value, the mystery drew more fascination than frustration. There were no people of interest, no clear motive beyond profit, and no physical evidence. Months passed, and the case quietly faded away, unsolved. But every now and then, when I see a modern computer boot up instantly, I think back to those old machines, and the unknown person who managed to outsmart everyone by swapping a few tiny pieces of silicon. It remains one of the most meticulous and clever tech mysteries I've ever encountered. Next story. This isn't my story, but one my grandfather used to tell from his years as a detective. He'd seen all kinds of strange and heartbreaking cases during his career, but there was one that stayed with him for the rest of his life. Not because it was the most violent, but because of how confusing and tragic it was. He was called to investigate a suspicious death involving a married couple who lived in a quiet neighborhood. From the outside, their life seemed ordinary. A modest home, steady jobs, nothing unusual. But that illusion fell apart one night when neighbors reported shouting and strange noises coming from their house. When officers arrived, they found the wife unresponsive, and the husband was distraught. During questioning, my grandfather and his team tried to piece together what had happened. The husband claimed that his wife had suddenly fallen into a medical emergency. According to him, she had started convulsing, and in his panic, he believed he could stop it by physically restraining her. His reasoning made little sense to anyone in the room. My grandfather later said that the man kept repeating that he thought he was helping her. The more they investigated, the less his story held up. Medical experts confirmed that the marks and evidence didn't match what he claimed. It wasn't an accident, and there was no misunderstanding. It was something deliberate. When the truth came out in court, the man was found guilty and sentenced to 15 years in prison. What struck my grandfather most wasn't just the act itself, but the way the man seemed detached from the reality of what he'd done. He didn't show anger, guilt, or even denial, just confusion, as if he truly couldn't process that his actions had taken someone's life. For my grandfather, this case became one of those haunting reminders that even ordinary-looking people can make terrible choices in moments of panic or distorted thinking. He often said it wasn't always the hardened criminals that stuck with him. Sometimes it was the people who seemed completely normal until one terrible decision changed everything. He retired years later, but he still talked about that case from time to time, not out of morbid fascination, but because it reminded him of how fragile judgment can be. In his words, "You never really know what people are capable of when fear takes over. It wasn't a story with heroes or villains, just tragedy, a moment that could never be undone, and a man who spent 15 years reflecting on a mistake that cost a life." My grandfather said it was one of the few times he didn't feel triumph for solving a case. Only sorrow for everyone involved. Next story. Not my story, and I'm not a detective. But this is one of the strangest and most haunting true stories I've ever heard. A close family friend of ours, now in her 70s, once shared something from her childhood that still sends shivers down my spine. She grew up in a small rural community in Wisconsin back in the 1950s. Life was simple then. Small towns, long winters, and neighbors who all knew one another by name. Her family used to host weekly card games at their home. It was a tradition, a cozy get-together filled with laughter, gossip, and comfort food. Each family in their circle had a role to play. Someone brought dessert, someone handled drinks, and one particular friend, a quiet bachelor who lived alone on a nearby farm, always volunteered to bring the main dish. He'd show up carrying a pot or slow cooker, proudly announcing that it was stew or roast made from something he'd hunted. Sometimes deer, sometimes wild boar, and occasionally, as he claimed, something he'd found along the back roads. In that community, this wasn't unusual. People hunted and foraged. Sharing food was part of rural life. For years, these dinners went on like clockwork. My friend said she remembered the man as soft-spoken but polite. A little odd, maybe, but harmless. He always had stories about his hunting trips, and would joke about how he could make anything taste good if you just cooked it long enough. Then, one winter, everything changed. The man stopped showing up. The card nights continued without him until news started spreading through the county. Stories that didn't make sense at first. Police cars, reporters, and investigators began swarming a property outside of town. The man everyone thought they knew had been arrested, and the truth that came out left the entire town in shock. What had been assumed to be harmless meals from hunting trips turned out to have a horrifying connection to something much darker. The family friend said that for years, she couldn't even talk about it. As the details of the investigation came to light, she and her family realized that the man who used to sit in their kitchen, laugh at their table, and serve them food was none other than Ed Gain, the same man whose crimes would later inspire some of the most chilling stories and movies ever made. She said the hardest part wasn't what he'd done. It was coming to terms with how close he'd been. How someone so ordinary seeming could hide something so disturbing. She spent years in therapy learning to separate the memories of warm family gatherings from the horror of what came afterward. To this day, she says she still can't eat stew without remembering those nights. And the man from Plainfield who was far more than what he seemed. Next story. About 25 years ago, I worked in a large, upscale hotel, the kind with glass elevators, marble floors, and endless hallways that always smelled faintly of citrus cleaner. It was a great job most days, except for one extremely weird mystery that had the entire staff scratching their heads. Every few weeks, someone would leave an unpleasant surprise near the ice machines on random floors. It wasn't just one or two incidents, it became a pattern. Security reviewed camera footage, maintenance checked the plumbing, and housekeeping was at their wits' end. No one could figure out who was behind it or why anyone would even do something like that. The mystery became sort of an inside joke among staff, the Phantom of the Ice Machine. We even made a running bet about which floor would get hit next. The managers weren't laughing, though. They called meetings, increased patrols, and warned employees that the culprit would be fired immediately if caught. Months passed, and the strange activity continued. It almost became part of hotel lore, something you warned new employees about just to see their reaction. Then one afternoon while on break, my coworker pulled me aside. He looked nervous but also kind of amused. After a long pause, he said quietly, "You know that ice machine situation?" That was me. At first I thought he was joking, but he wasn't. He said he started doing it as a prank, a way to break up the monotony of night shifts, and then it just became a habit. I didn't even know what to say. He laughed, shrugged, and said, "Guess I'm kind of a legend now." A few days later, he quit his job. Housekeeping was thrilled. The managers were relieved, and for the first time in months, the ice machines were safe again. The hotel moved on, and the Phantom became a story told only in hushed, half-laughing tones among employees who had been there at the time. A couple of years later, I ran into that same coworker at a local pool hall. He looked exactly the same, grinning, loud, full of energy. As we talked, he started boasting about another so-called prank he'd pulled. Apparently, he'd found someone's van left, unlocked in the parking lot, and decided to make it his next target. That's when I realized he wasn't just a prankster. He was someone who took weird pride in doing outrageous things. Just for the reaction, I never saw him again after that night. And honestly, I'm not sure what became of him. But to this day, whenever I see an ice machine in a hotel hallway, I can't help but remember the long-running mystery that haunted our staff for months, and the coworker who turned it into one of the strangest workplace stories I've ever experienced. Next story. I'm not a detective, and this story isn't firsthand. It's something I heard years ago about a private investigator who took on one of the strangest cases of his career. It started when a small neighborhood began reporting something deeply unsettling. Late at night, people claimed to see an elderly woman walking down the street, dragging what looked like human shapes behind her. She always appeared between 2 and 3 in the morning, moving slowly under the flickering glow of old streetlights. Neighbors described hearing faint scraping sounds, something heavy being pulled across the pavement. But whenever anyone tried to get a closer look, the woman would disappear into the shadows or turn down an alley. Word spread quickly, and soon the whole block was whispering about the Midnight Woman. Some thought it was a ghost story, others feared something much darker. Eventually, one of the residents decided to contact a private investigator to get to the bottom of it. The detective didn't expect much. He figured it was a misunderstanding or maybe a prank. But once he started interviewing witnesses, their stories were all eerily consistent. They all swore the same thing. The woman was dragging what looked like lifeless forms down the street. So, the detective set up overnight surveillance. He parked a few houses away from where the sightings happened, kept his headlights off, and waited. Hours passed, the streets were silent, and then, right around 2:30 a.m., he saw her. An elderly woman, walking unsteadily, a long coat draped around her, moving something along the ground behind her. His heart raced as he started recording with his camera. From a distance, it really did look like what the neighbors had described. For a few tense minutes, he watched as she dragged the figures down the empty street, stopping occasionally as if to adjust them. When he finally stepped out and called to her, she froze. The detective approached carefully, flashlight in hand. As the beam lit up the scene, the truth became clear, and it was nothing like what anyone had imagined. The woman wasn't dragging human bodies at all. She was pulling a small cart full of old broken dolls, arms, legs, and heads all mixed together in a tangled heap of fabric and porcelain. The shapes people had seen from a distance were just doll parts tied to a rope, clinking and scraping as she walked. When questioned, the woman explained, in her own quiet, confused way, that she used to make dolls for her children and couldn't sleep without taking them for a walk. It was both heartbreaking and strangely touching. The detective later said it was one of the most surreal cases he'd ever worked on, something that started like a horror movie but ended as a story of loneliness and fading memory. Next story, I travel all over the country with four of my fellow Olympic medalists, solving mysteries and uncovering strange cases that seem to follow us wherever we go. We roll up in our brightly painted van, affectionately called the Mystery Machine, with our loyal but slightly goofy dog riding shotgun. It all started after the Olympics. You'd think winning medals would be enough excitement for one lifetime, right? But no. Somehow solving crimes became our thing. We've been called to everything from haunted amusement parks to ghostly lighthouses, abandoned ski lodges, and mysterious old mansions with way too many secret doors. Our dog, bless his heart, is both our mascot and our biggest liability. He's scared of his own reflection, jumps 10 feet in the air when someone sneezes, and has an appetite that could bankrupt a small restaurant. But when the chips are down, he always manages to stumble, usually by accident, straight into the middle of the case, and somehow save the day. Every time we roll into a new town, the pattern's the same. Strange noises, disappearing valuables, and townsfolk swearing they've seen a ghost. Naturally, we're curious, and maybe a little too brave for our own good. So we set a trap, chase the ghost, get separated at least twice, and somehow all end up screaming down a hallway while our dog drives the van in circles outside. But it always ends the same way. After a wild chase, a bit of chaos, and a lot of teamwork, we corner the culprit and pull off the mask. And that's when it happens. Every single time. The unmasked villain looks at us in defeat, sighs dramatically, and says, "I would have gotten away with it. If it weren't for you meddling kids." Every time they say it, we can't help but laugh. Even the local police usually chuckle while taking the villain away. It's weird to think that a group of former Olympians ended up chasing ghosts instead of gold medals. But here we are, athletes turned amateur detectives, traveling the highways in a multicolored van with our cowardly best friend. And honestly, it's the best adventure we've ever had. Because under all the fake ghosts, smoke machines, and spooky rumors, we've learned that the real mystery is just how many people think putting on a mask will hide the truth. As for us, we'll keep cruising down the road, medals clinking, dog snoring in the back seat, and the open road ahead. Somewhere out there is another mystery. And another villain ready to underestimate a bunch of meddling kids. Next story. I'm not a detective, but about 8 months ago, I saw something on the subway that still unsettles me whenever I think about it. It was a quiet evening, one of those late rides where everyone keeps to themselves. The car was half empty, the rhythmic sound of the train echoing through the tunnels. I had my headphones in, watching stations pass by, when a man stepped onto the train at the next stop. At first, nothing seemed unusual. He looked tired, maybe a bit unsteady, wearing a dark jacket that covered his arms. But after a few minutes, I noticed that something about him seemed off. He was pale, breathing heavily, and staring blankly ahead. A woman sitting a few seats away asked if he could please put on a mask. He looked at her, and in a flat tone said something that made everyone around him freeze. It was clear he was talking about having harmed someone, and that he didn't plan to keep living either. The atmosphere inside the subway car changed instantly. No one screamed or ran. It was a kind of silent panic. People moved quietly away, some shielding children, others whispering into their phones. Within seconds, a few passengers had already called the police. The train slowed to a stop between stations, and over the loudspeaker came the announcement that there was an emergency. Officers and transit personnel were waiting when the doors finally opened. They entered quickly but calmly, talking to the man in low voices until he allowed himself to be taken into custody without a struggle. Afterward, everyone sat there stunned. Some passengers got off at the next stop, others just stared out the windows trying to process what had happened. I stayed seated, heart pounding, trying to piece together the last few minutes. Later that night, I searched the local news expecting to find reports about the incident. But there was nothing. No headlines, no updates, not even a brief mention. Maybe it was handled quietly, or maybe the man had simply been in the middle of a mental health crisis and no one wanted to sensationalize it. Still, the moment stayed with me. It was one of those reminders of how fragile the line between ordinary and terrifying can be. How one unexpected sentence on a subway can change the mood of an entire train car. Even now, months later, I sometimes think about that night. About how the car was silent except for the hum of the rails. About the way everyone worked together without saying much. Calling for help, keeping calm, doing what they could. And about the man himself, whose words were so disturbing yet said with such emptiness that it felt like he was already somewhere else. It was one of the strangest, eeriest moments I've ever witnessed, and one I don't think I'll ever forget. Next story. This isn't a story from a detective, but something a county prosecutor once told me that has stayed with me for years. He said it was one of the hardest cases he'd ever worked. Not because of the complexity, but because of the heartbreak. It was a case about betrayal, anger, and irreversible choices that shattered an entire family. It began as what looked like a domestic dispute that escalated far beyond anyone's understanding. A husband had been unfaithful to his wife, and when she discovered the situation unexpectedly, emotions spiraled out of control. In a sudden moment of rage, he made a terrible decision, one that could never be undone. After the confrontation, the situation in their home took an even darker turn. The man set part of the house on fire while his family was still inside. Flames spread quickly through the hallway, filling the rooms with smoke. Moments later, the man himself jumped from the upper floor and was taken into custody by responding officers. When emergency crews entered the scene, they realized how devastating it truly was. Investigators and firefighters worked for hours, trying to understand what had happened and to recover what they could from the wreckage. The prosecutor told me that even the most experienced officers were shaken. Not just because of the destruction, but because it all stemmed from something so deeply human. Jealousy, guilt, and anger. As the case unfolded, it became clear that this wasn't a pre-planned act, but a series of impulsive, catastrophic decisions made in the heat of emotion. It was a tragedy that destroyed not just one life, but an entire family. The prosecutor said that everyone involved in the investigation felt the same sense of disbelief. How a moment's rage could erase everything that once mattered. In the days leading up to the trial, the man was being held in custody. He had time to think about what had happened, time to face the reality of what he had done. Before the case could even reach court, he took his own life. The prosecutor said he never forgot that case, not because of the legal work, but because of what it represented. It was a haunting reminder of how fast life can unravel when emotions override reason, and how the smallest decision can lead to consequences that last forever. He told me, "You can study law for decades, argue 1,000 cases, and still never get used to the ones that make you see the worst of what people are capable of. Some cases don't just test your judgment, they test your humanity." Even years later, every time I think about that story, I remember the weight in his voice when he told it. It wasn't anger or disgust, it was sorrow. Genuine, human sorrow for lives that were lost, and for a family that never had the chance to heal.